All right, everybody, welcome back to another T-Rex Talk. This is, how many weeks ago was it, Charles? A few weeks ago, several weeks ago, after working on the many, many different projects between now and then, I've lost track of time. But we did the first half of a reading list. We talk about primarily Second Amendment books in that particular stream, so you can go back and watch that. This is the second half of the reading list, all the other books that didn't fall into that exact category but are still very interesting books we're going to be talking about for the next hour, as is our custom. But we're also going to be talking about some current affairs that these books relate to, and possibly even some upcoming events. I understand that there's going to be an executive order on some unconstitutional gun law. We're not sure which yet. That's theoretically happening tomorrow. So we'll be talking about that a little bit as we get through some stuff. So yeah, I know that you guys are wanting to me to summarize the stream that we did a few weeks ago. I can't really summarize that stream any more than we already summarized like all the books in that stream, except to say that this was the book, the kind of entry-level beginner's main important Second Amendment book. If you're going to start with one, if you want to recommend it to people, this is the book, Second Amendment Manifesto by John Payne. That is the one. We went through a bunch of Second Amendment books. They all had strengths. They all had weaknesses. If you're really curious about that particular part of the reading list, go back and watch the first one. All the books we talked about are in the video description. I'm going to put these books in the video description of this video. If I get to them all, well, I'll put in whichever ones I get to. So that's what we're going to be doing today. And we're going to talk a little bit about current affairs, as I said. So some of you, I know, are wondering why we're talking about books when we are, in fact, a gun company. But ideas have consequences. Knowledge is power. You know all those sayings. And you know that those sayings are true. So we are talking about the importance of knowledge and the importance of knowing stuff. And as you may have noticed, it's very difficult to learn things, despite the internet being an incredibly powerful place to get information. It's very hard to know if you can trust the information that is on the internet. You need to be able to verify that from other sources. Books are excellent other sources, particularly when you are studying history, when you are studying economics. Modern economics is basically garbage. You want to read economists who are older. You want to read economists from previous times in history. You want to read about the history of different economics policies that have been tried and failed. Not just the modern recent stuff. And there's a bunch of different ways where I think it's pretty obvious that it's just hard to get good information on recent things. Like, for example, just to give one example, Major League Baseball. On Friday, they moved an All-Star game from Georgia to somewhere else. Did you guys follow that at all? Don't really watch baseball, but I'm not going to start.
Going to Colorado.
Yeah, so the point, as usual, the reason that anybody does anything in the 21st century is apparently racism. Doesn't matter who it is. Apparently, the reasons for all decisions are racism, one way or the other. So Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game away from Georgia because of a change in voting law. So there's some new voting laws are going to go into effect in Georgia, and Major League Baseball guys said they were racist because they shortened the early voting time and they cemented the need for IDs and stuff like that. So they're out of there, and they're moving to Denver, Colorado, which turns out actually has voting laws that are just as bad, if that's your definition of bad, shorter early voting times, same requirements for ID. They wanted to be anti-racist, and so they left Atlanta, which I believe is the large American city that has the largest ratio of black-owned businesses to white-owned businesses. They left that city, and they went to Denver, Colorado, which is basically the opposite of that. So, it's an incredibly empty bit of virtue signaling that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't line up with any of the things that they said that they were trying to accomplish. With their move. In the same way that Disney complained about Georgia, I think it was late 2019, there was a pro-life bill that passed in Georgia. Disney protested that pro-life bill by pulling production out of Georgia and taking it to mainland China. They ended up shooting Mulan. I think it's like probably within shouting range of Chinese concentration camps. So, yeah, again, very empty virtue signaling move. And it becomes obvious that Disney doesn't really care about human rights issues when they do stuff like that. Major League Baseball, they don't really care about voter reform. They don't really care about black businesses. These things are super obvious to us. So these big companies are punishing the economy of Georgia for some other reason, not related to whatever it is that they say that they're talking about. And understanding why some of these ideologies exist and why people are doing some of the things that they're doing becomes far more apparent when you read about different ideologies or different economic practices throughout history than if you read these big companies' Twitter feeds. And just the way that big tech curates information for you, in one sense, it's fascinating and it's highly impressive, but in another sense, it just makes them completely untrustworthy. So the way that your news feed is curated specifically to you, you get spoon-fed the things that they want you to see, and they hide things from you that they don't want you to see. Like, that's a good reason to go back to books for a bunch of stuff and to study these things in greater detail. And also, they're just the length thing. Like, there are ideas that you can communicate in a book that are really hard to put into a tweet stream. And you can get books that they don't change. It's very hard to go and cite your sources inside of web pages when people just change their stories all the time. Usually they change their stories whenever they say something about Veritas Press. Legally, they have to go back and change that because they always lie about Veritas first, and then they have to retract later. But oftentimes they don't update the stories to let you know that they have updated their stories. So everything on the internet is just in flux. It's always suspect, and that's why we're talking about books. Now, obviously, I understand. I'm telling you to go read books on the internet. So not saying the internet is completely useless. I'm just saying get yourself some context, get yourself some facts, get yourself some understanding by reading books and understanding where we're coming from. So do we have any good questions, Charles? Anything in particular before we dive straight into book recommendations? A lot of people talking about baseball. A lot of people talking about Denver. Yeah. All states have liberal bastions nowadays. They do, and it's actually kind of interesting to me that there are some pretty significant companies based in Georgia that are kind of accidentally getting pummeled by some of these boycotts. Sort of interesting to watch. Someone asked, what's the first book you read that was really enlightening? One of the things that I do want to talk about, we make no bones about this here at T-Rex Arms. We are a Christian company, and I would say that reading the Bible from a young age and having my parents read the Bible to me and listening to the Bible is the most important starting point. And I think that that has had the biggest effect on me from just even a purely intellectual standpoint. And then books about economics are probably sort of the second thing where light bulbs went on and I started to connect dots together with some of the ideologies that I'd studied and then the way that those ideologies have immediate, serious, significant practical effects in people's quality of life. So I think that is, I don't know, those would have been history books more than like specific economics textbooks. We're also pretty anti-textbook around here, by the way. So, key historical stories that we can look to that would be similar to what we're currently experiencing. Well, funny that you should ask that question. Another thing that happened over the weekend, there were a number of church services that were shut down around the world, Good Friday services, Easter services. Governments going in and shutting down church services, threatening congregations with fines, with prison time. And actually, there's a gentleman who has been in prison. His name is James Coates. He's up in Alberta. He's been in prison for a number of weeks for refusing to obey certain Health Department of Alberta regulations relating to COVID. And so he wasn't obeying those. So they threw him in jail. He's actually out of jail now. He's been out of jail for a week or so pending trial. But they just yesterday, I believe, or possibly this morning, seized his church, and they've cordoned off the entire building. Nobody's allowed to approach the building. They've seized the property, and they will not let anybody near it. So that's a pretty fascinating development. But it's also nothing new. I think that this is a fascinating thing to go back and look for, because the church being oppressed by the state is something that happens throughout history in slightly different ways, and usually for slightly different reasons. But that is a very key tipping point for major change that generally happens. The change is either good or the change is bad. It depends on how the people handle that situation. So let's get into that a little bit. The Second Amendment Manifesto that we talked about last week is primarily about the Second Amendment of the United States Bill of Rights. So it's primarily about the United States and United States history, but there is a lot of history of what came before. And that is something that you have to know. There is so much more great, solid history of legal theory and the pursuit of liberty and freedom prior to the American colonies that you have to know. And so I actually have a book that I should have talked about last time through, but I hadn't finished reading it yet. And that is this one called Slaying Leviathan by Dr. Glenn Sunshine. And this book is, I'm just holding it here for the shot. So Slaying Leviathan is a fascinating book because it provides kind of an overview of all of the legal, philosophical, Christian doctrines that result in either shrinking the jurisdiction of government, the idea of limited government, or the opposite of that. Humanistic and Enlightenment ideas that lead to larger and more powerful governments. And I think that he does a phenomenal job of outlining those. Couple things I will say. One disappointment that I have with the book is it is called Slaying Leviathan, but it doesn't actually tell you how to slay Leviathan. I was hoping as I got through the book and it got shorter and shorter, I was like, okay, the Slaying Leviathan part is coming. Technically, a better title for this book would probably be Recognizing Leviathan. And he is talking primarily, he gets this idea of Leviathan my brain just went blank, Charles. I should have drank coffee more recently than I did. Who wrote Leviathan? I should grab my other notes. So Leviathan is, we don't really have time to get into all of the fascinating things that happened as people went from Roman Empire through early stages of the first century Christian church into the development of the larger centralized church that became the Roman Catholic Church, then the Reformation, then the Renaissance, then the Enlightenment, then all the other really interesting stuff that happened that led up to the American colonies fighting for their independence. Then things get crazy, and they get particularly crazy in the 20th century. I don't have time to go over all of that stuff. This book covers that tremendously well, but Thomas Hobbes, thank you very much, Daniel, for reminding me. Thomas Hobbes wrote a book on Leviathan, and he was one of the Enlightenment guys who was like, look, the only way that we can control people is if the government is just huge, if the government is just gigantic, if the government is just basically all-powerful, and it is a Leviathan. That is the way that we will actually be able to accomplish good things in this world. The only way that we can do this is if the government is just basically unlimited in its scope and its power. And he certainly wasn't the first person who wanted to do that. Roman emperors, Persian emperors, Babylonian emperors, the idea of ultimate power has appealed to a lot of different rulers in the past. But he really made a strong case for the all-powerful state that was pretty widely read by a lot of people in the time. So people are posting Thomas Hobbes quotes. People are posting Calvin and Hobbes quotes. And then someone here has posted a Joe Biden quote. Hobbes said that if you really believe in something and you love it, then you anyway. Yeah, no, that checks out. That totally sounds like Thomas Hobbes. So that is, so getting back to Slaying Leviathan, Glenn Sunshine is specifically going through the history of the different ideas that have come out of these different religions. Someone says here, talk about reliefs, don't specify religion. Religion is responsible for millions of deaths, so don't give me this thing like religion, blah, blah, blah. No, these are all religions. They are all religions that either believe in the God of the Bible, the God of the Quran, the God of something else, or in the case of Thomas Hobbes, technically he really believed in the God of the state. The state was going to be, and Max Weber said this later, Thomas Hobbes didn't say this. There was a guy who built onto the original work of Leviathan, and he said that the state is God walking on earth. That's what the state is. And there's actually a picture. I'm not sure if we can get this in here, but this is the cover of the original Leviathan book, and what it is depicting is a king who is made up of hundreds of thousands of little faces, and he is essentially a god walking on earth, bigger than all the little tiny people down here. That was the vision that Thomas Hobbes had. It was not that different than the vision of Plato that you read about in Plato's Republic, a state that is so big and so powerful that it has the ability to control everybody, and then everything will just be perfect and it'll be good and everything will be nice. Obviously, our founders did not believe that. They wanted a limited state. They wanted a state that could be contained, that had a jurisdiction that was limited, and that would be enforced by the constitution that they wrote. It would be enforced by magistrates that swore an oath to uphold that constitution, and by the people who had the right to keep and bear arms, and the government was not allowed to infringe upon that right. So that is an extremely important philosophical and political principle that comes directly out of scripture, which you can find in this book. This book does a great job of explaining where some of these ideas came from, how they were developed, how they were integrated, how they were argued against by different people. But I will say that when you get this book, going into it, you do need to understand it from a Christian context. And this book is written for Christians who are wanting a historical overview of some of these political ideologies. So that's what you're getting in the book. Highly recommend it. If you know that going in, if you think this is actually like a manual of fourth generation warfare that you actually use to slay Leviathan, not so much. If you just hate the idea of Christianity or people following the Bible or the idea that throughout history, Christian civilizations have grown and built their legal theory and their philosophical theory on the law of the Bible, then this book will make that very clear to you and you won't like it. So just heads up, that's what is inside of this book. But I will say that I vastly prefer a book that presumes that the reader is going to know some Christian history and know some Bible than a book that's written by somebody who doesn't. So there's another book that I read in the last couple of weeks, which I don't recommend. I'm not even going to mention the title just because I think it is kind of confusing. But it's a very interesting book because trying to figure out how to say this exactly correct. The author did a phenomenal job at research. He did a phenomenal job at reading a ton of original source material. And he pulled some amazing quotes from primarily pastors in the United States of America, before they were the United States of America, pastors throughout the colonies, and the things that they said about government, and the things that they said about war, and the things that they said about liberty and freedom that led to the war for American independence. And it's a neat book. It's a great place to find some of those source materials and find some of those neat quotes. But it's also a very confusing book because the guy that wrote this book didn't really understand some of the basics of Christianity. So we'll have a quote from a Presbyterian preacher, and then he'll be like, I don't understand why this guy held to this position. Like, why do the Calvinists hold to this stuff? Because we all know Calvinists believe that everything's predestined and therefore they're all fatalists. So why would they possibly want to build a new country? He kind of understands things through the lens of Christian stereotypes as opposed to what Christians actually believed and lived. And so he pulls these great quotes out, and then he's like, this all lines up. This is incredibly consistent across all these denominations, but I don't get it because I tend to follow stereotypes as opposed to actually understanding some of these theological doctrines that they're leaning upon. So that was kind of frustrating to me because it's a great resource, but it's far more confusing than this book that presupposes that you're already aware of some Christian principles and presuppositions and are starting from that point. So, yeah, I know it's complicated to get through some of this stuff, but there's a tendency, particularly if you go with pure textbooks, to just simplify everything and just be like, Rome, good, church, bad, giant state, good, and then gradually we get more freedom as time goes on. That's just how it happens. And it's far more complicated than that. I should do a Jordan Peterson thing. I just lost his voice. I can't even do the impersonation, but he's just talking about it. It's very complicated. It's real complicated. This stuff is incredibly complicated. Now, I will say that I'm starting from the Christian presupposition. The founders of the United States were Christians. They were attending church. They were listening to sermons. They were spending far more time listening to sermons being delivered by guys who were incredibly well-read and incredibly rigorous in their thinking about Scripture. They spent a lot more time doing that than reading Thomas Hobbes. But they did read Thomas Hobbes, and they quote a number of people in the Enlightenment. But if you look at the country that they built and the constitution that they wrote, it's trying to do the opposite of what Thomas Hobbes wanted to do. So was there Enlightenment influence in America? Absolutely. The idea that some of these pastors were these backwoods, I mean, this is the modern, I guess Hawthorne started this. This is the modern stereotype of the Puritan. Somebody who wants a gigantic government that keeps people stupid, makes them just bow before blind faith, and then executes them if they ever have any fun. That is the modern stereotype of the Puritan. But in the 1600s, in the 1500s, Puritans were people who were criticized by the Anglican Church for wearing clothes that were too colorful, and drinking too much beer, and being too happy about the future, and not wanting to obey the king, and stuff like that. It's in many ways the exact opposite of the stereotype that we have now. And that's why when you read books by people who have bought into that modern historical misrepresentation, even when they go back and read some of the historical documents, they're like, I don't get it. I know that this guy just wants people to be stupid. So why is he reading Thomas Hobbes? And I know he just wants the government to be big enough to execute anybody that has fun. So why does he want everybody to be armed and not listen to the king anymore? And that makes no sense. Obviously, these guys were just completely incomprehensible and not consistent at all. Learn your history so that some of this stuff can make more sense. How are we doing for time, Charles? We're about halfway in.
About 25 minutes.
Any good questions so far? Yeah, someone says, Jordan Peterson, Kermit the Frog impression. Yeah, Kermit the Frog impression. Then a little bit of Canadian, okay. Long pauses to indicate deep thought. The problem with the Jordan Peterson impersonation is you also have to have read all the material and be actually wise. So that's very hard to pull off. Shall we talk about, let's talk a little bit about children's books. Cause I think that will kind of, give a little bit more of a foundation to what I've just sort of said. If you have these presuppositions that are not based in reality, it is hard to make sense of some of the things that our founders did. If it's true that all our founders wanted to do was increase slavery of everyone, then why would they have a Second Amendment? And there are people on the internet right now, there are commentators on the Second Amendment that paint the founders as white supremacists that wanted a giant government to put everyone under their heel. And so if that is true, then the Second Amendment must be talking about a state militia and not private citizens. And so understanding the world that they lived in, and I mean understanding reality, is an extremely important part of being able to understand some of these ideas properly. So let's talk about children's books. I got a lot of questions about those in the last stream. And I have three small children who are, they get read to quite a bit. Oh, so while we're talking about the Second Amendment, this is Paul Revere's Ride. Illustrated by, can you punch in there, Charles, so I can read it? I could turn it around, but then we'll lose focus. Ted Rand. So this is the Longfellow poem. Not a huge fan of the Longfellow poem, but I am a fan of these illustrations. So these illustrations here are not cartoony. They're not, they're a little bit stylized, but this is good art. I want my kids to be around good art, to be consuming and appreciating good art. And I want something that does not cartoonify or just make this very real serious situation that I want them to understand less serious or goofy in ways that are not helpful. So I appreciate books that are realistic in this sense. Now, it's not scary, it's not gory, but just talking about the realities of the situation that the colonists were in, like I appreciate books that are not abstract or rather stylized to the point of abstraction. And I want my kids to be reading stuff like this and building pictures in their mind that they can they can put books that they read in the future on. So building shelves in their mind, rather, where they can organize the information that they get later. So I'm a little bit picky about art in books. I want art in books to be good if it's, well, period. But if it's for children, I want the art to not be too silly and goofy. So that's a phenomenal book for that. And the topic is good. And again, you know, the Longfellow poem's not super accurate. Not a huge Longfellow fan, but this is the great thing about kids that are too small to read. You show them the pictures, you tell them the story. I will say the Curious George books in my house, often very different than the Curious George books actually turn out once the kids learn how to read. So Curious George is a far more repentant monkey at the end of each book when I read it. Ah, interesting. So this will be, I'll talk about that one last. Peter Speer is a Dutch illustrator and writer. Same thing. These are books that depict a very realistic world. He's got a watercolor style that is extremely simple, but it's very detailed in a way that is depicting reality. And this is something that I want my kids to understand, a world that is real, and not be reading children's books that are just fluff, and then when they're old enough, they get stuff that's helpful. And I think this stuff is incredibly helpful for building the basics of an understanding of the world, historical or modern. And this is a great book. This book is called Father May I Come. It starts out showing the people that go out to rescue stranded ships in the Netherlands in the 1500s and what that looks like. And just the parts of life of that time and the difficulty and selflessness of the people that go out to rescue the ships, and the part that everybody in the community plays in being part of the rescue mission. And then, as you keep going, you then get to modern Amsterdam, which I guess this book is like from the 70s, so not strictly modern, but more modern. And it's exactly the same thing. People have different jobs. The boy goes around and tells everybody that there's a ship that is stranded. They have completely different equipment. The little boy gets to go because it's much safer than it was back in the 1600s. They explain exactly the process. The back of the book even has like blueprints showing all the parts of the rescue ship. So like, this is a way better book to be reading small children than a bunch of random abstract stuff. Now, we could talk about Dr. Seuss, but I'm pretty sure we're not allowed. Pretty sure Dr. Seuss banned for all sorts of horrible, horrible crimes. So Peter Speer, not yet banned, even though he's far, far more terrifying than Dr. Seuss ever was. But his books about history, his books about farming, everything about these books I really like and appreciate for different reasons. And I like showing my children books that they can look at the pictures of and they can just get interesting details out of the illustrations. So like, here is a barge that's about to go down the Erie Canal. We can talk about all the stuff that's getting loaded on there. We can talk about how they take care of their animals and what they feel like. Every picture is just packed with detail, even though it's real simple, real easy to read and understand. So those are the kind of books that I'm looking for my kids, because I want to create some level of, again, I don't have a great word for it, but as they learn stuff, they're building the shelves in their brain that they're going to continue to put information on as they learn it. So books that are realistic and helpful, like The Oxcart Man, which is a book about family economy. It's a book that, LeVar Burton makes this look so easy. Again, colonial family. They farm, they take care of animals, they grow crops. And then every spring or every summer when they're done collecting and harvesting, or I guess that would be fall, they load everything up into the cart, they take it and they sell it, and they buy the tools that they need for the next year's worth of work. And they work together as a family to create products and sell them for money to buy tools so they can continue to grow their family economy. And, you know, what a cool message for small children. It's not just what so-and-so did at school. It is a whole bunch of different lessons all in one. I appreciate that a lot about these books. And I'll have some more children's books out there. Some of these children's books, speaking of censorship, Dr. Seuss is canceled. A number of people have been just really hard to come by. Peter Speer books they're so great. They're so inoffensive. They're really hard to find, and some of them are just out of print. And it's not clear what the reasoning is. They're just kind of hard to come by. Another one that you probably have heard of is Richard Scarry. Richard Scarry has a great book called What People Do All Day. But the old version of the book is better because it has a chapter about what mothers do called A Mother's Work Is Never Done. It shows a mom taking care of kids, cleaning up the house. Like, that's one of the chapters that is interspersed with people who are mailmen and people who are building houses and people who work in paper factories. The books that you buy now from Richard Scarry are either counterfeit books drawn by somebody else because the Richard Scarry estate no longer owns the rights, or his own books that have been modified so that the really interesting parts are gone. I'm pretty sure the next edition of What People Do All Day will also not have the chapter on Sergeant Murphy because he's a police officer, got to defund the police officers, get rid of Sergeant Murphy, bananas, gorilla. Oh, that might be racist actually. So maybe that's why that chapter is going to be gone. So yeah, so What Do People Do All Day, if you can find the old version, is cool. Even if you can't find the old version, those kinds of books I think are very helpful for children. And they provide children with a kind of an understanding of the economy. People do work, they get money, they're able to spend money on these things that other people have made. That's how the exchange of goods and services go. So that brings me to, I'm not sure how hard this book is to find these days, but it's called Biblical Economics in Comics. Trigger warning, it's biblical economics. So there you go. And this is done by Vic Lockman, who was a Disney artist back in the day, back in the old days. So, I mean, I'm sure he's canceled. But it's a phenomenal book. My kids love to look at the pictures of this book, even though they cannot read the words quite yet. But it goes through basic economics. It's kind of not working to show pictures, but it's really nice artwork, and it shows how economic systems start from the ground up, how you build tools to increase your output, how you are able to take what it is that you've created that's your excess or your surplus, and you use that to increase your capacity. And he goes through everything. He goes through inflation. He goes through all kinds of different economic concepts that are tremendous. And I think he does a phenomenal job at exegeting from scripture biblical principles of economics that are extremely important. Things like in Proverbs 3 or 4, I forget which it is now. I should have had notes on this sort of thing. The Lord hates unjust weights and measures. And what that actually means in terms of different kinds of currencies that are not money, but currencies that are inflated and not attached to anything. And so they are worth more or less at different times in an unjust way. Stuff like that is inside this children's book, Biblical Economics in Comics. It's fun enough for kids, but it's strong enough for adults. What other economics books do we have? We should talk about economics, we should talk about history, and then we should probably go to our rogues gallery. What other economics books? Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. That's another good one. It looks like a surprisingly thick book for something that says economics in one lesson, but this is just the one lesson is the front. Then there's more explanation and individual cases and further study in the back if you are so interested. So economics in one lesson is great. I think I have the Thomas Sowell book, Basic Economics. You might ask yourself, why does a book called Basic Economics have to be this thick? But, well, it just is. Thomas Sowell is great. He's one of the few people who's still alive that's teaching decent economics at this point. And I recommend that you check that out if you want to do any more contemporary economic study. So these are important books to be reading. Understanding economics is a very important way of understanding kind of the building blocks of civilization and culture. And one of the reasons, going back to what we talked about earlier, one of the reasons I believe that people are boycotting Georgia and various other states for accused racism and stuff like that. The reason that that is happening is because people particularly want to punish Georgia's economy and transfer that money, that economic success, elsewhere. So take the dollars that they were going to spend in Georgia on shooting Disney Plus TV shows and spend that money in communist China instead, or take the money that was going to be spent on the All-Star Game in Georgia and spend that money at Coors Field instead in communist Colorado, prop up that economy just so that there's fairness. certain economies must be punished for being too successful. Other economies must be propped up because they're not successful enough, because equality and outcomes. That's another point that I forgot to bring up when I was talking about kids' books. I read a study years and years ago from England, and it was a study that basically, or it was an article that said, studies have shown that reading to kids is good for kids. Kind of doesn't matter what you read to them, but the more you read to your kids, the better. The better they do. And since there are children out there that aren't getting read to, you should stop reading to your children because it's unfair. You need to basically hobble your children and nerf them to the level that all other children are being nerfed so that they can become the lowest common denominator along with all the other kids. Obviously, I don't prescribe to that theory when it comes to raising my children, but I don't prescribe to that theory when it comes to individual states either, or individual businesses. So this kind of nerfing the system or nerfing specific states or specific economies or specific companies so that they don't succeed too well is very problematic. And that's why a lot of these economics books and political books that I've been talking about are helpful to read so that you have a better understanding of times that this has happened in the past. Georgia is majority black state. Yeah, I believe it's 51%, which might actually be more than that after a lot of people have moved there recently. But that doesn't mean that you can't boycott the entire state because racism. That's what big corporations are going to do. Is Mises on your reading list? Yes, but I don't have any of his books. I actually have a number of books that I don't currently have that I should probably talk about, even though I don't currently have them with me. I almost rode my bike to work today, but I didn't think I could carry this many books with me, and probably could have squeezed a few more in. Not one mention of Thomas Sowell being black. That's how it should be. Yeah, well, the people who talk about Thomas Sowell being black all the time are not the conservatives who are putting him on their recommended reading lists. It's actually the other side. Explaining that he's some sort of, I don't think I'm even allowed to say some of the words that white liberal academics describe Thomas Sowell as. I would be instantly canceled if I said some of that stuff about him. Let's see, you guys need to have a gardening seminar where you show people how to grow their own food properly. Okay, so that is an interesting question. I've showed a number of children's books that take place in the past in a more kind of agrarian setting. Is that something that we're really particularly recommending that everybody do? No, not exactly. But the books that I'm reading my kids right now, we just finished My Side of the Mountain, which is a great book about living. It's not a survival book, but it's a living off the land book. The first one, not the sequels. Then we have been reading Laura and Mary, which is another great book that's politically unacceptable at this point, but it's about homesteading and pioneering times. And I think that's really helpful for my kids. We're also reading some James Herriot. I'm reading select James Herriot stories to them about a country vet in Britain. I guess the book that we're in now is in between World War I and II. And so here's a question. Are we looking for some kind of agrarian future? Am I training my kids to be farmers? No, but I think that having an understanding, the norm of all of human history has been people doing subsistence farming or one or two levels above subsistence farming. Farming is an incredibly important thing. Understanding farming helps you understand a lot of the language in the Bible. Understanding how incredibly hard the work was that was being done by the people who began this country and built this country. All of these things are incredibly important. So I really want my children to have an understanding of the kind of discipline and perseverance that the pioneers had and understand where food comes from and not just take it for granted that we don't have to do farm work. And we are going to have animals at some point, but more as a teaching lesson for everybody than being completely self-sufficient. Just in case, having a good idea of what is involved in being self-sufficient is something that I want people to have. So we're not the people to do a massive homesteading project. We're too busy being a manufacturing house, but those are important skills, and those are things that I want my kids to know. Which brings me to another book that I forgot to bring up earlier. Eric Sloan is a an author and illustrator who is a historian who studies New England tools and building stuff. And again, he's not writing for kids. He's writing for adults. He's documenting this stuff as a historian. But my kids love this book. My kids love books that show how bridges were built. And this story, Diary of an Early American Boy, follows a family as they build from a small farm. It starts out, this is a very cool thing to show, if we can actually show it. I wish we had the full reading rainbow set up for this, but they start out with a very small farm in a forest, and over the course of the book, they manage to build this farm up to the point where they have a larger house, they have a larger barn, they have a mill house where they're able to do an awful lot of work and have built a bigger bridge and clear the area. And as they build more infrastructure, they're able to do more things. And as the son gets older, he's able to help with more stuff. So you can see this building. If you do this work, if you're diligent in these areas, you're actually able to accomplish more. These are things that come across in books that are extremely important for kids to read, or adults. These are principles that are kind of being lost. These are principles that are kind of gone away as we have this idea that no. What you do is you get your college education and you get your job and you do the bare minimum to keep your paycheck. You do whatever it is that you want to do in your free time, and then hopefully retirement comes soon. As opposed to, you can build a economic system of your own. You can build wealth. You can build civilization. You can build a community. You can build things that have an upward trajectory. You don't just sustain. You're not just going from raise to raise to raise. You're actually trying to build something above and beyond just to being a timestamp person. So that is something that I do want my kids to learn, but everybody needs to understand that. And there are other books on economics that I think demonstrate this really well. Here's one. We could talk about this book for a long time, not just because it's very thick, but The Wealth and Poverty of Nations by David S. Landes is a very cool book. It talks about why some nations are rich and why some nations are poor. He talks about technology, which I love. He talks about cultural stuff. There's a lot of reasons why some nations are rich and poor, and obviously there are climate reasons, and there are natural resource reasons, and there are cultural and historical reasons, but he goes into all of those things, and it's fascinating to see the way that certain inventions, and I've talked about this on previous live streams before, previous podcasts, an invention will come along, and the countries that adopt it and make the best use of it first get a phenomenal economic boost over the countries that do not. And a lot of times, it's just a question of who gets it first. But more often, many countries have access to the same technology, and their cultural values will determine whether they actually utilize this thing properly. And that's an incredibly important principle. Another person that talks about this is James Burke. I don't have any of his books here, but if you look at him, his first series, Connections, is on YouTube. It's quite good, I warn you. He has a pretty amazing 1970s leisure suit on for the entire show. So just, you're forewarned. Also the glasses. Be prepared for the glasses. But other than the fact that it was made in the 1970s by the BBC, it's quite good. So I would check that out. The book is excellent. He has a bunch of other books on similar topics, the way that innovation drives innovation, the way that civilization builds, the way that one invention will lead to another, and so forth. So I'm trying to think where we can go from here for our last 15 minutes, because there's so much stuff. Historical studies are incredibly important for understanding some of these things and plugging them all together. Here's a book that I love and I can't categorize, Skunk Works. This is a book that is about the development of the F-117 stealth fighter and the SR-71 and the U-2. This is written by Ben Rich, who worked at Skunk Works, the Lockheed top secret airplane development place. The reason I love this book is because it connects so many dots. It's very hard to categorize because it's a book that it is about engineering, it's about scientific research, it's about manufacturing, because they had to build a lot of the tools that they needed to build these brand new secret aircraft that were based on scientific research they couldn't tell anybody about, that they were doing kind of alone. There's business development, there's team management, there's aviation history, there's international espionage, political intrigue, military strategy. It's all in this book because that is driving what they're trying to do. And it happens over decades. So you see all of these things changing throughout history. So this isn't a book on any one of those things. This is a book that if you read about any of those other things, you can see the dots kind of connecting between the different stuff that you've studied, and it makes sense. It starts to bring clarity and context to some of those other things that you've looked at. So if you have any interest in any one of those topics, this book is going to shed some light on stuff you've already read. And it's also well written enough that it's probably worth looking into. Just if you have any interest in aviation, the military industrial complex, science, engineering, Cold War strategy from a surveillance and strategic perspective, it's worth looking into. But again, it covers a whole bunch of different stuff, and it's a good connect the dots kind of thing. Business books, political books. It's so hard, Charles, to know what we should actually do.
Well,
to finish out the stream.
People in the comments were talking about current events. So I think you mentioned this before, but a lot of what we're seeing now has already happened.
Yes. Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun. We're seeing things that are pretty similar to stuff in the past. That's part of the reason that I recommend that you read The Great Christian Revolution, which I did talk about in the last stream. And so many of these resistance to tyranny books, like Doctrine of Lesser Magistrates, the Magdeburg Confession. We covered these in the last stream, but there are people that have faced similar issues to the ones that we have been talking about as a company. Gun confiscations, weapon confiscations, a state that is constantly growing in its power and oppressive capability, and what do free men do in that situation? These are things that have been addressed by Pierre Verret in The Christian and the Magistrate. These are things that get covered really well in Slaying Leviathan, the Sunshine book that we talked about earlier. And as specifically relating to America, the Second Amendment Manifesto, probably the best starting point for studying that in an American context. But all of these things that you will read in good, solid, truthful history books are things that if you really think about them, you can apply and get really good stuff out of. And to go back to a point that we made earlier, we are coming, again, from a Christian presupposition that the Bible is the norming norm of norms. It is the standard by which we judge all of these books, because none of these books are perfect. There are no perfect books. There are books here that are really, really good, and there are books here where there's some meat and there's some bones. You gotta get as much good as you can out of the meat and then spit out the bones. And another book that I wanted, or another idea that I wanted to talk about is there are bad books that are worth reading so that you understand the ideas that are in them. So one of the things that we are seeing in the United States now is an increasing desire for more socialism, more statism, more communism. So it's probably worth actually going through something like the Communist Manifesto or Saul Alinsky's books, because the stuff that's being done today, a lot of that is, like, they're not even changing their work. It's obvious, some of the ideas that they're running with. So reading some of those books, but knowing the context is, I think, extremely important. So in addition to the read list, we've talked about having a rogues gallery. I do have stuff like Darwin and Marx and Engels in my library. And I think that that's very important that you have that and that you're somewhat familiar with. Now, my kids aren't reading that. I'm not giving that as reading assignments to small children or teenagers that don't have much discernment. But as I want my children to grow in discernment, I actually want them to be able to be aware of that stuff and to be able to pick that stuff apart and to be able to read that stuff so that they know what's happening in the world. And we all need to be striving for that level of discernment so that we can, again, read books that are meat and that are bones and to read books by some of the bad guys in history. Like, I mean, we were talking about Thomas Hobbes earlier. That's a hugely problematic book, but hugely influential. It's the sort of thing that you should be familiar with, but only if you're able to really understand why the ideas in it are problematic, if you have a larger context, which is why I think that it's really important that we do go back to Scripture being that standard by which we determine what is freedom and liberty, what is righteousness and what is foolishness. That is an extremely important part of all of this. And a lot of these books struggle with that issue because they don't have that standard. So Wealth and Poverty of Nations will point out that there are cultures that are remarkably successful economically and others that aren't for no other reasons than cultural. And he can point out which ones are which, but he doesn't delve super deeply into why a value for human life comes out of one but not another. And why that value for human life results in them ending slavery and using animal power and using wind power and using water power as an alternative to slave power. He doesn't really talk about why that is, but it's pretty easy to read between the lines and know which civilizations are doing that and which civilizations are not. So that is something that I think is an extremely important thing for us to remember as we're reading this stuff. But again, most of the books that are on here, I really do highly recommend these books. But again, in the context of trying to find truth, not just stuff that we agree with, not just stuff that we like, not just stuff that props up our own presuppositions that we currently have and enjoy, but we are trying to understand reality better. We are trying to understand history that is true. We are seeking the truth. And because of that, that's one of the reasons that the Christian position is anti-censorship. It is important that we keep books like Communist Manifesto around. Even though we reject the concepts in them, that's not something that we're trying to get rid of. That's something that we're trying to learn from and overcome. And I do have one really, really bad book, Charles, that I found out about today. Should we close with this terrible book or should we take another question? Okay, so I'm going to have to do this so carefully. Or not, or I could just not. Okay, so there's a book that is currently on the New York Times bestseller list. It's currently on Amazon. It's currently being sold by Target. So this is a modern book. So it's called A Rhythm of Prayer, and it is a collection of meditations for renewal. And it's not written by Sarah Bessie. It's compiled by an editor named Sarah Bessie. So it's a whole bunch of different people that have written these different prayers and meditations. And one of them that I'm going to talk about specifically, if I had the book here, I'd probably read for more than one person. But I'm only going to read from one person because I have the whole prayer from this one person. I'm going to get you some pull quotes from it. As a Christian, as someone that believes deeply in the importance of prayer, I apologize in advance for how silly I'm going to make this sound, but it's not entirely my fault. So, the prayer begins, "Dear God, please help me to hate white people, or at least to want to hate them. At least, I want to stop caring about them individually and collectively. I want to stop caring about their misguided racist souls, to stop believing that they can be better and that they can stop being racist." So that's the beginning of the prayer. End quote. I just point out this prayer is written by an associate professor of practical theology at Mercer University. So this is ostensibly a professor of theology named Dr. Walker Barnes. So yeah, that's how the prayer starts, and it actually gets worse from there. I just like to point out the person who wrote this prayer is asking for the supernatural power and sanctifying influence of the omnipotent Holy Spirit, of the triune God, to change their heart so that they won't believe that God has the supernatural and sanctifying power to change white people's hearts to be less racist. So it's very problematic theologically, even just like logically and grammatically. Should we keep going, Charles? I mean, I think this is sort of self-evident that it's a problem. And she goes on to say she's not even talking about members of the KKK. She is talking specifically about just good, nice Trump voting people. She says, "Lord, if it be your will, harden my heart. Stop me from striving to see the best in people. Stop me from being hopeful that white people can do and be better. Let me imagine them instead as white hooded robes standing in front of burning crosses." Okay, so, end quote. Again, I cannot believe that this is not made up, but it is. It appears to be completely legit. It is on the New York Times bestseller list. It is in Target as we speak. The Amazon reviews seem legit. Dr. Walker Barnes has a page on Mercer University. She has a bibliography. This seems to all be real. And what she's praying here is that the Lord will harden her heart, which is a thing in her defense. This is a thing throughout Scripture. God hardens the hearts of people, but it is the exact opposite of what Christians are supposed to ask for. We are supposed to ask that God would take away our hearts of stone and give us hearts of flesh. The softening of hearts is the thing that we are supposed to pray for. And she's asking that the Lord would help her to imagine these people who are not white-hooded KKK members. She's asking God to help her imagine that they are. So she's asking God to help her have faith in things that are distinctly not true, which is the opposite of the kind of faith that we're called to ask for in the Bible. We're supposed to believe in things that are true and to ask for a greater faith in things that are true. So this is hugely problematic. Free me from this burden of calling them to confession and repentance. Okay, I'm actually going to just stop there. End quote. That's the end of what I'm going to read. She is asking for the Lord to free her from the burden of calling white people to confession and repentance. Which, I mean, this is heresy. Demanding that God allow you to make exceptions from his commands based on a hate that he has commanded you not to have is heresy. Now, that being said, I'm going to buy this book, and I don't want this book to be burned. I don't want this book to be gone. The people who want to erase things from memory and from existence are not on the side of seeking truth. Now, when I buy this book, I'm not going to buy it now. It's already on the New York Times bestseller list, but it's going to be like Prayer of Jabez. There's going to be a million of these things in half-price books and McCall's within a few months. So that's probably where I'll get it. There's going to be a bunch of them. There's still like 8 million Prayer of Jabez books for 50 cents in every used bookstore in the country. This will probably be, you know, not quite as many. I want to have a copy of this book for a number of reasons, but there is an idea out there on the internet that conservatism and Christianity is the ideology of censorship and trying to destroy stuff. That is just not the case. That is absolutely not the case. When you look through Christian history, you will find Christians dealing with heresy all the time. You will see Christians addressing heresy because that is what they are called to do. They're called to proclaim the truth of the gospel and to fight against ideas that take us captive through empty deception, to fight against lies, but to defeat darkness with light and defeat lies with truth. So there is there's something that people will bring up in Acts 19 where there were a bunch of people who were saved, and a number of those, I'm reading from chapter 19, verse 19, a number of those who practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found that it came to 50,000 pieces of silver. So some people point at this verse and they're like, no, the church wants to destroy bad books. Now, these were people who were saved and they were destroying their own property publicly to demonstrate that they turned away from it. There's nothing else in Scripture that says that this is the way that you deal with things that are problematic. And if you look through the early church, like Council of Nicaea, for example, so St. Nicholas allegedly punched Arius in the face, but he did not claim that Arius had never existed. That may be apocryphal, but I kind of hope it's true. I kind of hope it is true that St. Nicholas walked up to Arius and he was like, gonna give you a lump of coal later and a lump on the jaw now. That would have been like a very cool intro to the Council of Nicaea. But this is the way that the church has predominantly dealt with heresy. Whenever the church is biblical, it defeats lies with truth. So that's a book that I don't want to be eradicated from the face of the earth, even though I still hold that it is heresy. That's a book that is worth having so that we can remember, among other things, that this particular professor of this particular university actually said that at one point in time. And because in the future, we're going to want to have arguments against that kind of heresy and be able to make those biblically. And we're going to want to have economic arguments against communism. We're going to have to be able to make historical arguments against gun control. And being able to retain our history and know it is an incredibly important part of learning from the past, which is why the leftists tend to actually be the book burners. They call us Nazis, but they're the ones that actually want to ask everybody for their papers and burn all the books and pretend that uncomfortable things in the past never happened. So yeah, yeah, that explains a lot of things. So my recommendation to you guys is to buy books and read them. And if it helps to start with the reading list that we have been compiling, then that's great. And if you find other good books, please let me know. We're always on the lookout for good books. We're always on the lookout for tools that will help you guys be more effective in the things that you are trying to do. And like the title of the talk says, we're trying to build liberty. We're not just fighting. We're not just resisting. We're actually building at the same time. We have to do all of this stuff at once. So the most effective tools that you can have are truth and righteousness and ideas that communicate those things. So hopefully you enjoyed this this particular book review section. We're going to keep finding new books. I have a whole bunch of stuff that we didn't get to. This is a book that I found in between the last two streams. So I know that we're going to keep doing stuff, and looking forward to seeing you guys next Wednesday. What do you think the T-Rex talk will be about next time? Think it'll be a new product launch?
Leaks.
Oh, leaks. Well, could be leaks. Could be politics. We had a fascinating guest, speaking of books. Fascinating guest yesterday. I didn't have a particular category for this book, but Dr. Mark Green was able to spend some time interviewing Saddam Hussein after his capture. That's a fascinating book. I still don't know exactly what category to put it in, but it's amazing. You should totally get it and read it. And maybe we'll talk about it next week. We'll probably talk about something else. We'll see you then. Thanks for watching.